Good morning, all you magnificent melon heads of the world. Happy Wednesday, everybody. Today is February 18th, 2026. And our top story this morning is the European Central Bank. Across the pond, Christine Lagarde is rumored. We don't have a confirmation here, but everybody is talking about this one. She is rumored to be leaving early as the president of the European Central Bank, basically Europe's J-PAL. She wants to quit. Why would she do that? That's interesting. Well, it seems the political winds may be shifting in Europe, and, well, they want to get their guy in charge. Now, look, we've seen this before. Christine Lagarde was rumored to be leaving the ECB at one point last year, that she was going to go take over at the World Economic Forum as she was going to be like the new Bond villain at the little gaggle of global elites, you know, the people who get together and tell us all to eat bugs and ride to work on high-speed electric roller skates while they live a life of luxury. Well, that ended up to not be a thing. She said she was going to stick around. But this time around, there's no denial from the European Central Bank. They're not out with any statement that says, no, this isn't true, this is a false rumor. No, they're just out with a statement that basically says she's focused on her job. And she's, or as Jay Powell would say, my colleagues and I are squarely focused on our dual mandate of price stability and maximum employment, neither of which have we achieved for the American people. But yeah, that's just the Federal Reserve's version of things. So what's going on in Europe? Well, they're worried. You've got Macron over in France is on shaky footing. He's probably not looking so good in the next round of elections. You got Merz in Germany doing better than Macron, but not by a huge margin. You have a lot of Euro-skeptic political winds are shifting in Europe. And, of course, anything in Western press is going to describe this as the radical right, the far right, or we'll just label them all pro-Russian, or we'll use the N-word to describe them. Anything to make them look crazy and, you know, oh, anyone who doubts our globalist, elitist gaggle of leadership is obviously far, far right. Well, what's going on here is they're worried that the elections are not going to go their way. And so they're trying to, Lagarde's term would be up middle of next year. They want to get her out of there so they can go ahead and appoint their friend to another multi-year term. In other words, in this article in MarketWatch says it, they are looking to future-proof the European Central Bank against a Euro-skeptic government in France or Germany. In other words, they're trying to make sure that the election doesn't affect the outcome at the central bank. Oh, what happened to the cries of my central bank independence and, oh, my Fed independence, and central banks are supposed to be immune to political winds, and that's why we want to go ahead and stuff the central bank before the election changes the political thing a little bit. Oh, that's right. We only talk about Fed independence when the other side is in charge. All right. When we cut rates to affect elections, we don't talk about Fed independence. All right. When the Fed is arbitrarily juicing the economy in order to make one person look better, we don't talk about European Central Bank independence. Oh, the other guy might be taking power. Quick, let's stuff the leadership with politically friendly forces. Now we don't talk about the independence of central banks. That's interesting. Look, this also comes amid a backdrop of Europe is just absolutely going bonkers with defense spending, as is the United States, by the way. And you could see that in the durable goods numbers that were released this morning. Defense spending is propping up the U.S. economy along with other things. The European Central Bank is expected to turn on the spigot of stimulus very soon here in order to finance this big military buildup. And, well, they're worried about a change in the politics affecting the European Central Bank's willingness to monetize all that debt to rebuild Europe's army. And so they're just trying to stuff the leadership roles. Now, we've also got other things going on today. We have some details of the U.S. trade deal with Japan. The first $36 billion of what is said to be $550 billion was announced this morning. A small amount relative to the size of the larger deal. It seems most of it is going to go to this gargantuan natural gas plant that they want to build in Ohio. 9 gigawatts, or roughly 9 nuclear reactor sized natural gas plant in Ohio that is almost certainly going to be used to power data centers. And apparently that's what we're getting for our tariffs. Also, they're talking about building an oil export terminal off the coast of Texas, as well as an industrial diamond plant. That industrial diamond plant is interesting. Technically, they're calling that critical minerals. I haven't heard a lot about industrial diamond dust as a critical mineral. It's on the list, supposedly, and it's important to U.S. industry. I'm not really familiar with the technology, though. Now, we also got a lot of AI headlines starting late yesterday into this morning. Now, this is interesting, and you can see how the press is trying to shape the narrative. First, we've got these articles that are like front and center in CNBC and Bloomberg this morning. OpenAI and Anthropic deals power Abu Dhabi's $100 billion AI bet. Oh, my God, look at all the money. Look at the strong words. Oh, it powers this deal. And then you get into the fine print. And you realize what a dud this story is. The $100 billion AI bet is actually only projected to be $10 billion a year for the next 10 years. So they're only spending $10 billion this year. Also interesting is that they are spreading it out across multiple companies, OpenAI, Anthropic, as well as several others. It's not all going to one company. All right, so what does this actually mean? This actually means Sam Altman is coming home empty-handed. Back in January, we saw a lot of headlines talking about how Sam Altman was in Abu Dhabi, he was in the UAE, and he was trying to raise $50 billion at a $750 billion valuation for OpenAI. And those headlines were all over the place in January. And all the stories about AI financing mentioned Sam Altman's road trip in the Middle East about how he was raising all this money in the Middle East. And instead, we get commitments for $10 billion per year spread among multiple companies, which means the UAE told Sam Altman to go pound sand, of which there is ample supply in the UAE, I'm told. Got a lot of sand over there. Now, we're not going to put that in the headline, that Sam Altman swinging a miss trying to raise money from the oil sheiks in the Middle East. No, we will say OpenAI and Anthropic deals power Abu Dhabi's $100 billion bet. Quick, everybody, change the subject. Then we recycle a headline about Meta and their spending on NVIDIA chips, which is not news, but they made news out of it. The article broke yesterday. Meta has reaffirmed their commitment to buy millions of NVIDIA chips, which they were already going to buy anyway. And the article even explicitly mentioned this just reaffirms their commitment. No new deals announced, no new spending plans. We just took an old headline and we recycled it to try to make sure people didn't notice that Sam Altman tried and failed to raise money in the Middle East to pay for this. And just a reminder, this recycled Meta headline yesterday, this comes just 6 days after Meta's auditor, Ernst & Young, flagged their use of off-balance sheet debt to pay for their data centers when they got into bed with crooked private credit firm Blue Owl in order to finance all this stuff somewhere in the dark, shady corners of the AI bubble where the prying eyes of auditors and shareholders can't see it. So you can see how they just manufactured positive news out of awful news yesterday in the AI bubble. And, well, don't say I didn't warn you. Nobody saw this one coming. All right, other news going on this morning. We've got a spike in repos yesterday. Not a huge spike, but sizable. And it's kind of interesting because it happened midweek, mid-month. That's something to keep an eye on. It's not a problem yet, but we're going to take a look at that one. What else do we have? Zohran Mamdani, he got a communist doing communist things in New York City. He wants to raise property taxes by 10% to pay for free shit for everybody or whatever it is they're going to do. Whatever it is they're paying for, it certainly isn't the removal of excrement on the sidewalk. That picture was making the rounds on Twitter yesterday. There's hopefully dog poop everywhere in New York City. If it's not the dogs, I don't want to know what left it there. But yeah, 10% spike in property taxes in New York City. That's good because, you know, the guy campaigned on lowering the rent and nothing lowers rent like raising property taxes. Am I right? Isn't that how that works? Oh, maybe we'll just move on. British Columbia, meanwhile, this story in British Columbia is pretty wild. And this is coming soon to a New York City near you. British Columbia is cutting 15,000 jobs and still their spending and debt levels are going to rise. Wait till you see some of the numbers associated with the finances in British Columbia. I don't know what the hell they're doing up there in Arctic Mexico, but they are not paying attention to what's going on in their books. And we're not much better here. And the Europeans are trying to stuff some friendly person in charge at their central bank to make sure they can keep doing it over there. And then we wonder why we get headlines like the boom session. That's the new story in CNBC this morning. The boom session. That's their new phrase. The vibe session, that's out. The boom session is in because we're no longer admitting or we're no longer pretending the economy isn't shit and we're saying, oh, the economy is great. The problem is you and your bad vibes. If only, you know, you pessimistic doomer YouTubers would stop being so negative, we'd all realize how good we all have it. No, we're not pushing that phony narrative anymore. Now we're calling it the boom session, another jobless recovery. The economy is growing. GDP is expected to grow at 2.7%, and yet nobody can find work, and everybody's pessimistic about their finances. Why? Because this boom session is fake. We've been in a recession since 2022. They just don't want to admit it. They've papered over it with the biggest accounting fraud in human history, the AI bubble, as well as $2 trillion annual deficits, spending as if we're in the middle of World War II and a depression at the same time, when really we supposedly weren't. In other words, the economy really is awful, and they're just finally starting to admit it instead of gaslighting the hell out of people. And last but not least, private equity. Oh, we got to end the show with a private equity story, right? Private equity, they're not just dumping their garbage investments into your 401k. Oh, no, no, that is yesterday's headline. Now they're actually buying your financial advisor so that they can make sure they dump all of their toxic assets into your 401k. Wait till you see this one. They are buying up financial advisor firms. They're buying up insurance companies. They're buying all the people who make the decisions on where to allocate capital. And in a shocking turn of events, they end up allocating capital to the crap that they desperately need to sell. Isn't it funny how that works? Guys, we got a lot to talk about this morning. Why don't we shrink my big melon of a head and let's see what's going on in the world of finance. Don't forget that like button. New guys, hit that subscribe button right next to it so you can come back tomorrow and have your coffee with the melon heads. Right now, the S&P 500 is higher by 15 points or 0.23% to the upside, although we are well off the highs of the morning. The Dow is up 74 points, 0.15% in the green this morning, and the NASDAQ is leading the way higher, up about a quarter of a percent or 60 points higher, although all three indexes are currently trending lower off their highs of the morning. The dollar is surging again this morning. We have had 2 days in a row of significant gains in the DXY. Right now, the DXY is up another 27 basis points to 97.39, that stronger dollar, and that's relative term, right? Yes, we're up from the low 96s to the mid 97s here, but a year ago, we were well over 100, so let's keep that in context. But that higher dollar will be putting some downward pressure on asset prices this morning. Looking over at the bond market, we've got yields rising pretty much across the board here. The 30-year yield is at 4.703, higher by 2 basis points. The 10-year is at 4.077, higher by 2.5 points. The 2-year is at 3.459, higher by 2 points and change. And the 1 month is the lonely red name here. We got 3.685% off by about half a point for the 1 month T-bill. Looking over at the commodities board, metals are looking good this morning. Spot gold is at $4,959. That's higher by $82 or 1.69%. April COMEX gold futures are at $49.80, up by $74 and change, 1.5% higher for gold. Spot silver is at $76.95, up $3.41. That is 4.6% higher. Relatively tame move in silver, but still these $3, $4, $5 intraday swings, we just can't seem to get a break from those. COMEX March silver futures, $76.94. That's also higher by $3.38 or 4.6% in the green. I like the shiny. Copper is up by 1.88%. Platinum 3.39% higher. Palladium higher by 4.25%. Crude oil is up by 2.68%. That is interesting this morning. $63.94 for April WTI futures. We've got more planes and more things that go boom are headed for the Middle East right now. The market finally taking this one seriously. Yesterday, that news about the partial temporary closure of the Strait of Hormuz, the oil market just kind of shrugged that one off. This morning, they seem to be paying attention. We've got more tankers, more fighters, more bombers, more everything heading to the Middle East, along with more warships. There's still time to switch it off. Doesn't have to go this way, but they seem dead set on it. Meanwhile, Bitcoin is lower again this morning, just holding above 67,000 here at 67,000 and we'll say $70, down by about $300. Bitcoin remains in this, we'll call it a flag pattern or a triangle pattern, which looks like a bearish continuation to me, and it looks about to break down out of it. So keep an eye on Bitcoin, guys. We're down almost 50% from the all-time high already, and the blow-ups and the bankruptcies this winter haven't even really started yet. We've had some stories about, you know, withdrawals getting frozen temporarily, and Binance has been blowing through their $1 billion of reserves in order to prop up the price of Bitcoin. They actually finished off that $1 billion SAFU fund. It's all been pumped into Bitcoin now, and it's done very little to affect the price. I just feel like there's a big story in crypto just around the corner. It's felt that way for a while now. And even as we've been waiting for that, Bitcoin has still been heading south in a big way. But here's the big one this morning: why ECB's Lagarde may leave her post early. Lagarde and Macron may want to future-proof the European Central Bank against a Eurosceptic government in France. My central bank independence. Oh, yeah, there it is. We don't like the way the election might go, so we're going to stuff our person in charge. A report that European Central Bank President Christine Lagarde is leaving has stirred speculation about why she might depart. The Financial Times reported Wednesday that Lagarde will leave her position in October of this year, a year earlier than scheduled. It's not the first time Lagarde has been rumored to exit, as she was previously linked to a possible move to the World Economic Forum that would also necessitate vacating her ECB leadership ahead of schedule. The European Central Bank has responded to this report without an outright denial by stating President Lagarde is totally focused on her mission and has not taken any decision regarding the end of her term. It kind of sounds like they're confirming, not confirming this story. While speculation over the identity of a successor is likely to be intense, a desk note from Nomura's senior Europe economist, Andres Shispazniak, predicts that policy impact of a premature departure would be very limited. Why would the policy impact be limited? Because they would be making sure policy doesn't change if the election goes against them. Lagarde's tenure and those of fellow executive board member Philip Lane and Isabel Schnabel is set to end in October of 2027, and leaving earlier would enable President Emmanuel Macron to select a successor before the French presidential election in April of 2027. The intent, Skispaniak writes, would be to future-proof the ECB from the far right under the assumption that the National Rally will win the French presidential election. So much for that central bank independence. Things aren't going our way, so we're just going to rig the central bank to make sure they keep endlessly printing money and monetizing debt, taking the continent in a direction that the election is supposedly going to tell us they don't want to go. Huh, that's interesting. Meanwhile, we've got some deals about the Japan trade deal. They finally came in. Trump lauds Japan's pledge to invest $36 billion in U.S. oil and gas and critical mineral projects. All right, $36 billion. It's a far cry from the $550 we were promised, but I'm told this is just the first round. U.S. President Trump has welcomed Japan's pledge to invest nearly $36 billion in oil, gas, and critical mineral projects in Texas, Ohio, and Georgia. The commitment represents the first tranche of investments by Japan following a landmark trade deal between the two countries, one in which Tokyo pledged to invest $550 billion in American-based projects, and Trump cut tariffs on most Japanese imports to 15%. By far, the largest investment is a natural gas facility in Ohio that's expected to generate 9.2 gigawatts of power. Great Scott, Marty, that is a lot of gigawatts. That is a huge power plant. U.S. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick said the Portsmouth Powered Land Project, valued at $33 billion and operated by SB Energy, a subsidiary of Japan's SoftBank, would be the largest natural gas generation facility in history. Where is SoftBank getting the money for this? They just spent everything they had on OpenAI, but I digress. The White House said Japan would also finance a $2.1 billion deepwater crude export facility off the coast of Texas. At full capacity, the Texas Gulf Link project is expected to generate up to $30 billion in annual U.S. crude exports. Dallas-based energy infrastructure group Sentinel Midstream is developing that project. The Commerce Department said the third major project refers to plans to create a synthetic diamond grid facility in Georgia, with Japan set to invest approximately $600 million. So we're getting into much smaller numbers now. That project is set to be operated by Element 6, which is part of the De Beers Group, the world's leading diamond company. Diamond grit, dust, and powder are critical raw materials in U.S. industrial manufacturing due to their exceptional hardness and wear resistance, the Commerce Department said, making the material critical to U.S. economic and national security. All right, so we got a little bit of critical minerals, although I don't think diamond dust is really what they had in mind with the panic over critical minerals. But most of the money is going to this natural gas project And what is the natural gas project probably going to power? It's going to power data centers, of course. So look, we should be investing this money in building ships. Japan is the world's third largest shipbuilder, but instead we're building power plants to power data centers we don't need, which leads us to this one. OpenAI and Anthropic deals power Abu Dhabi's $100 billion AI bet. Let's see if we can make this headline sound as positive as possible when really this is Sam Altman coming back empty-handed. Government-backed AI investor MGX has a bullish plan to spend up to $10 billion annually over the next few years. Oh, up to $10 billion. So $10 billion is the max. They're not even going to do that. That's interesting. MGX was conceived in 2023. Shortly after the launch of OpenAI's ChatGPT sparked a global scramble for dominance in artificial intelligence, Abu Dhabi decided it needed a dedicated investment vehicle, creating a fund that now ranks among the world's most consequential backers of the technology. When Anthropic unveiled participants for its latest funding round this month, the firm joined as a co-lead investor. That followed a run of high-profile bets from MGX, which is racing toward a target of more than $100 billion in assets under management, backed by Abu Dhabi's sovereign wealth and its deep ties to Wall Street. See, that right there is salt in the wound. Sam Altman goes in January to the UAE. He's courting MGX. And what do? They announce that they're investing in their biggest rival, Anthropic, who took the money and ran Super Bowl ads mocking the ads that they're putting in. Okay, but I digress. To get there, MGX plans to spend as much as $10 billion annually on select companies over the next few years, its AI investment chief, Ali Osman, said in an interview. Those figures are staggering for a standalone firm. Again, they're putting as positive a spin on this as possible. Even by the standards of Abu Dhabi's constellation of investors that have poured tens of billions of dollars into finance, technology, and infrastructure in recent years, Osman acknowledges the pace is striking, but his rationale is simple. He expects generative AI to grow into a $700 billion market over 5 years, a forecast larger than many midstream predictions. Amid that broader uncertainty, MGX is powering ahead. Alongside Anthropic, the firm has also taken stakes in OpenAI and xAI in an unusual investing hat trick that's given it exposure to three of the most closely followed firms ahead of potential public listings. It joined BlackRock on a $40 billion takeover of Align Data Centers last year, teamed up with Silver Lake Management on a deal for a chipmaker, and has helped assemble a consortium seeking to raise $30 billion to fund AI infrastructure. So they're casting a pretty wide net here, but the thing is, up to $10 billion a year is what they're spending across all of these companies. And again, keep that in mind against the backdrop of this. This is what they were saying just a month ago. OpenAI's Altman meets Mideast investors for $50 billion round. All right, now this was in January 21st, and the ChatGPT maker was looking to raise $50 billion or more in the round at a valuation of about $750 to $830 billion. He went to the UAE trying to get $50 billion at a $750 billion valuation. And what we got was MGX investing up to $10 billion across multiple companies, no mention of OpenAI specifically, no mention of evaluation. In other words, Sam Altman came home empty-handed. And if he had come home with that $50 billion, you better believe we would have heard about that front page news within minutes. But we don't hear about it because the financial press will always circle the wagons around this bubble, up to and including telling people, don't listen to me. Instead of that, we got this story. Meta deepens NVIDIA ties with PAC for millions of chips. Oh, millions of chips. There's Greg Zuckerberg, the Bond villain, wearing his stupid glasses with cameras that invade your privacy. Oh, yeah. Meta Platforms has agreed to deploy millions. Dr. Evil's pinky there. Millions of NVIDIA Core processors over the next few years, tightening an already close relationship between two of the biggest companies in artificial intelligence. Meta, which already accounts for about 9% of NVIDIA's revenue, is committing to use more AI processors and networking equipment from the supplier, according to a statement Tuesday. For the first time, it also plans to rely on NVIDIA's Grace Central Processing Units, or CPUs, at the heart of standalone computers. The pact reaffirms Meta's loyalty to NVIDIA at a time when the AI landscape is shifting. NVIDIA systems are still considered the gold standard for AI and generate hundreds of billions of dollars in revenue for the chipmaker. But rivals are now offering alternatives, and Meta is working on building its own in-house components. Why are we even talking about this? Why was this even a headline? The pact reaffirms Meta's loyalty. That's the story. It's almost like they were desperate for a positive spin on AI yesterday because Sam Altman failed to raise the capital in the Middle East that he was trying to. And so we've got Meta reaffirms their commitments or deepens NVIDIA ties, millions of chips. Never mind the fact that just 6 days ago, we got this in the Wall Street Journal, Meta's auditor Ernst & Young raised red flag on data center accounting. Their auditor already is telling them, hey, Meta, the way you're paying for these millions of chips is sleazy and you're going to get yourself in trouble. You're kind of doing the whole Enron thing. But no, we need a positive spin. So millions, deepening ties, powering Abu Dhabi's commitment. It was a big swing and a miss yesterday, but they managed to make a positive spin out of it. All right, this is one to keep an eye on here. We are looking at overnight repurchase agreements. This is the repo market. And there was a lot of talk on this on Twitter yesterday. I don't think this story by itself is that big a deal. But I'm going to mention this one just in case it's the start of a trend because there are some unusual things about this. Last night, overnight repurchase agreements hit $30.5 billion. It was a pretty even split between U.S. Treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. So there's a couple of peculiar things. First of all, that $30.5 billion, you're probably going to look at this chart and say, that's not that high. We had higher numbers at the end of December. We had higher numbers at the end of October. Well, the December spike you would expect at the end of the year, at the end of the quarter, that's known as window dressing. A lot of companies tend to make big transactions around that time. So you would expect that spike at the end of December, slightly less the one at the end of October. That wasn't a quarter end, but it was a month end. You could, to a certain degree, expect it. But then you had like 2 months of relative quiet here. We had nothing in January and nothing in the first half of February. And then all of a sudden, we get $30.5 billion yesterday on a Tuesday in the middle of February. There was no reason to expect a spike in repos yesterday. So I don't think the $30 billion number is that alarming. Typically, people tap the repo window. They'll park treasuries. They'll park MBS when they need to temporarily raise cash. It can be a sign of a firm getting into trouble. And that's why I'm mentioning it. By itself, $30 billion, not that big a story. But if we see these numbers continue for several days in a row, that means somebody out there is on shaky footing. All right. So that's the only reason we're going to mention that. In a vacuum, this is a non-story, but there's a couple of things like the big gap at the beginning of the year, the spike at the end of last year. It's worth mentioning. All right. Meanwhile, we've got Mamdani warns of nearly 10% property tax boost if no tax on the wealthy. A communist raising taxes. Say it ain't so. Yep, this is news, apparently. New York City's mayor says drastic measures might be needed to fund his proposed budget. Well, you get what you vote for. There's Zohran. Yep, okay, let's put a millennial communist in charge of the financial capital of the world and expect no consequences. Mayor Zohran Mamdani proposes raising New York City's property tax by nearly 10%, having failed so far to persuade New York Governor Katie Hochul to increase taxes on corporations and the wealthy. Higher taxes for rich corporations and individuals remains his first choice, Mamdani said Tuesday as he shared his proposed budget for fiscal year 2027. If those options are off the table, his budget recommends raising city property taxes by 9.5%, which would generate $3.7 billion. He also called for drawing down the city's reserves by $1.2 billion to help close a looming budget deficit. We do not want to have to turn to such drastic measures to balance our budget, Mamdani said, but faced with no other choice, we will be forced to. What he also didn't mention in this article is that he also talked about raiding the retiree health plans in order to close his budget. He is spending everybody's money, and that's the thing with communism. Eventually, you run out of other people's money. Mamdani, a democratic socialist. Let's stop with that. He's not a democratic socialist. Mamdani is a full-on communist. Let's stop pretending he's not. He is. He campaigned on raising taxes on the wealthy and corporations to pay for many of his initiatives, such as free childcare and free bus service. Increasing taxes on corporations and on the wealthy, however, requires the approval of the state legislature and the governor. He campaigned on something that wouldn't be within his power to do. Hochul, a Democrat who is up for re-election this year, has opposed raising taxes. She said Monday that the state would steer $1.5 billion to New York City over 2 years to help address that cash crunch. And, well, that's not enough. Well, keep in mind, Mamdani, besides, campaigning on raising taxes on the wealthy and the corporations, he also campaigned that the rent was too high and that we need to do something about affordability. Can somebody tell me what raising property taxes by 10% is going to do to affordability? Anybody? What do you think? Are corporations just going to eat that? Or do you think just maybe they're going to raise the rent? Just an idea. Or maybe they'll just default on their debt and turn the keys over to the lender and cause a banking crisis. Pay attention, Flagstar Bank, who holds the debt on most of the rent-controlled apartment buildings in New York City. It's going to be a rough couple of years. Batten down the hatches, New York, and put a clothespin on your nose. Things are going to get smelly in that city. And meanwhile, we got the same thing going on in British Columbia. The numbers in this story are just mind-boggling. British Columbia to cut 15,000 jobs, but spending and debt will rise anyway. Oh, good. So we're laying everybody off and we're still going to spend more and put you further in debt because we're doing such a good job in British Columbia. Canada's third most populous province will chop 15,000 public sector jobs, increase income taxes and delay investments. But its left-leaning government avoided making deep cuts to sprawling spending plans and expects debt to continue rising. Look at just what a wonderful basket of leftist goodies we've got here. We're laying off 15,000 people. We're raising taxes. We're delaying investments, whatever that means. And still we're going to increase spending and the debt is going to go up. Oh, what a wonderful job they're doing there. This is not an austerity budget yet. No shit, said Finance Minister Brenda Bailey at the province's annual fiscal update in its capital city of Victoria. British Columbia expects a deficit of 9.6 billion Canadian dollars, or about 7 billion U.S., in the current fiscal year ending March 31st. That's despite a hiring freeze and a spending review that the shortfall is forecast to grow to more than 13 billion Canadian dollars in the next fiscal year. It's not just going to grow a little bit. They're going from 9.6 to 13. They are exploding their deficit. You can't cut your way out of a deficit, Bailey added. Actually, that's the only way you can get out of a deficit, but I digress. She said defending the plan sees annual expenses rise to 8.5 billion Canadian dollars by 2029. Driven by spending in key ministries like health, which accounts for about a third of the budget, debt will increase to 234.6 billion Canadian dollars by early 2029 from its current level of 154.1 billion. They are exploding this debt. That means 8.2 cents of every dollar in revenue will be spent on interest compared with 4.9 cents this year. They are just spending themselves into oblivion. Although British Columbia's new ruling New Democratic Party inherited a surplus when it took power in 2017, it has overseen consecutive credit downgrades since Premier David Eby became leader in 2022. And I can't imagine why their credit is being downgraded. I mean, all they're doing is they're cutting jobs, raising taxes, ballooning the deficits, doubling the debt. I mean, and they're doing a great job there. And maybe this is just why, just maybe this is why we get phrases like the boom session, why Americans feel left behind by a growing economy. At least they're not gaslighting us anymore. At least they finally ditched the vibe session, but now they're calling it the boom session, the recession that never was. Welcome to the boom session. The term is a portmanteau of words, boom and recession. It highlights how the average American doesn't feel like they're reaping the benefits of an economy that is, on paper, humming along, according to creator Matt Stoller. The average American feels like they don't feel like they're reaping the benefits because they're not. Economic output and the stock market are surging. Consumers are spending big, and the post-pandemic recession that many expected never materialized, even though we just spent the last two paragraphs describing that recession. But many feel terrible about their finances with debt at all-time highs, and the majority of Americans incorrectly believe the country is in an economic slowdown. Now, let me ask you, if the majority of Americans feel like the country is in an economic slowdown, maybe the problem isn't the incorrect beliefs of the average American. Maybe the problem is your metrics and your economic models all suck and they can't see the economy, the recession that has been sitting on their face for the last 4 years. Just maybe that's the case. Traditionally, the economy is doing very well, said Stoller, an anti-monopoly advocate and researcher at the American Economic Liberties Project. But ordinary people are saying they're not. It's thematically similar to the vibe session, a term popularized in 2022, to explain the disconnect between solid economic data and negative consumer sentiment readings exiting the pandemic. It can also draw comparisons to the K-shaped economy, a phrase illustrating how Americans can feel vastly different depending on their income bracket. And honestly, like enough of these stupid like mishmashes of words, vibe session, sasspocalypse, boom session. The K-shaped economy, that says it perfectly. That's all you need to know. Very few people are on that upper K doing very well. Everybody else is on the downslope. And they keep coming up with these phrases to describe it. This economic growth is an illusion. It's all just the biggest accounting fraud in human history, the AI bubble. It's runaway government spending. It's endless supply of new debt. And it's all going to come back to haunt us. And even that is not enough for 90% of the country. We're taking fewer vacations. We're eating cheaper food. We're shopping at Walmart instead of the nicer places we used to shop because people are broke. Just time to start admitting it and stop pointing to the stock market. And last one, you're going to love this one. The 401k takeover. Private equity muscles in on retirements. Now, we've talked about this for a while, about how private equity is selling their investments to 401k plans. But that's not what this article is talking about. The private equity firms are actually taking over the 401k plans. Wall Street power players are squeezing into the U.S. retirement industry. Its gatekeepers are succumbing. And that's the important thing there. They're doing it. It's happening. They're getting away with it. Every time the phone rings, Eric Daly can practically hear private equity coming for America's 401ks. The line has been ringing a lot lately at his modest consulting business in Portland, Oregon. For at least part of the year, he's been getting a half a dozen calls a week from private equity and other firms interested in his company, and even more since the start of 2026. He's gotten used to hearing the same question from the other end. How much for your firm? What makes Little Multnomah Group a hot property? It offers advice to 401k retirement plans. What was once a glossless business has since become a prize for buyout firms, which see the steady growth of the $14 trillion market for U.S. defined contribution retirement plans as a potential source of juicy returns among big backers or firms such as Genstar Capital and General Atlantic. The primary purpose is to try to infiltrate the retail marketplace, Daly says of the overtures. To him, the end game is obvious: to monetize the nation's 70 million 401k account holders. And understand what they're saying there, guys, to monetize your 401k. They are trying to use you as dumping grounds for toxic assets that they can't find anybody else to buy, even if that means buying out the firm that manages your 401k, who, by the way, is supposed to have a fiduciary duty to act in your best interests. Keep in mind, nobody's asking questions about this now. They'll all be asking questions during the congressional hearings after all this blows up. Privately, some consultants and advisors, including ones who now find themselves working for private equity-owned companies, worry that alternative asset managers ultimately might try to keep winning investments for themselves and for their institutional clients and dump losing ones on less discerning retail investors, according to industry participants who spoke to Bloomberg. Private market executives say that concern is unfounded. So what do you think? Why are they suddenly buying 401k management firms? Probably the same reason they're suddenly buying insurance companies, so that they can load up the balance sheets of these companies with the toxic sludge that they can't sell to anybody else. Good God, guys. I've been warning about this for months. It is happening. It's happening in real time. They're doing nothing to stop it. So I take steps to protect yourself, whatever the heck that may mean. And hey, I just want to say thank you very much to Mr. Hunt and Cover, who says, there's Travis. Where's Armando? Oh, are we doing this? We're calling each other out in the super chats again. Thank you, Hunt and Cover, for supporting the channel, sir. Lily Von Stoop says, Googled diamond dust used in underground drilling. Yeah, drill bits, the heads of drill bits is the most common use for synthetic diamonds because of their hardness. I just have never heard about diamond dust being a critical mineral. It's not something I hear like that there's a big shortage of. Apparently there is. But when I hear critical minerals, I'm thinking like neodymium and gallium, some of those really rare things that the Chinese completely control the market for. Thank you, Lily, for being a melonhead for 10 months. Travis again says, Armando is here. Why is everybody picking on Armando, man? Hey, thanks, Travis, for supporting the channel. I don't know what's going on in the chat, but there's Armando. Thank you, Armando, for being here reliably, sir. Appreciate the super chats and the support of the channels, you guys. Okay, Mr. Four Piece says, Jack's pants are blue, shirt is eggshell white. Actually, it's bone. Sorry. It's Egyptian braille. Are we doing what was Bryce's name? Or no, show me Paul Allen's business card. I want to see what that one looks like. But as a matter of fact, my pants are blue, but I'm not going to stand up. Actually, joke's on you guys. I'm not wearing any. It's a family show, for crying out loud. Thank you, Mr. Four Piece, for supporting the channel, sir. Real Estate Mindset says, wrong, Jack is wearing no pants. Travis, you see right through me. Nobody knows me like you do, brother. Thank you, you bonkers, SOB, you. And hey, we also got Not Pedro Pascal. Okay, Not Pedro. He says, hey, how come CoreWeave is trading better than SLVR? Well, CoreWeave is an outright, it's a fraud. I'll just say it. CoreWeave is an off-balance sheet arrangement for NVIDIA. And if there's one thing this market and this economy loves, it's fraud. It's white-collar crime. It's freaking everywhere. And so I'm not terribly surprised CoreWeave is doing well. I'm surprised people are dumb enough to not see it. I mean, at this point, it's incredibly obvious how CoreWeave is a company that was just totally stood up, propped up for the sole purpose of inflating NVIDIA's sales. And after this company goes belly up, that's what everybody will be saying. Mark my words. It's just when the stock is still up, people, nobody talks like that because they want their number to go up. But all these a-holes, Shkreli and Banana and all these guys and Wojastic who stood up in front of CoreWeave, they'll all freaking disappear, except for Shkreli. He's shameless. But everybody else will disappear when this company goes belly up. And the only way CoreWeave doesn't go belly up is if NVIDIA just outright buys them to avoid the headline risk of CoreWeave going belly up, which I think that's actually a very good chance that happens. Thank you, Not Pedro Pascal. Who else? We got Clueless Panther. What's going on, sir? He says, how much of big tech earnings is AI startup value? Okay, so I don't know about AI startup value. Big tech earnings, I know Microsoft took a big boost to their earnings because of an accounting change because OpenAI just made the transition to a for-profit entity. And when that happened, Microsoft took a big jump in their valuation of OpenAI, and that showed up on their earnings. Also, SoftBank did the same thing. SoftBank completely manufactured their earnings by increasing their valuation of OpenAI. Now, on top of that, a lot of OpenAI's spending shows up as cloud revenue at Microsoft, at AWS, at CoreWeave. All right, so I would say a lot of big tech earnings, or at the very least, a lot of their revenue is derived from this spending at these AI startups like Anthropic and OpenAI, which constantly lose money. That's the important thing to remember. Most of this cash is being sourced from investors. If they can't raise more money from investors, then OpenAI and Anthropic can't continue operating at these huge losses, and they can't keep artificially creating a market for NVIDIA's chips and for these data centers that Microsoft and AWS and everybody else is building. And that's why it's such a big deal that Sam Altman is coming back empty-handed from Abu Dhabi, because he's over there in the Middle East trying to raise that money to keep the charade going a little bit longer, and he was not able to do so. So where are they going to get the money from next? I don't know. I guess we'll just have to wait and see. Thank you, Clueless Panther. I would say it's significant, although I wouldn't try to quantify it. Carolina Joe gifted 5 Nobody Special Finance memberships. Thank you very much, CJ, sir. I appreciate that very much. Welcome to the Melonheads, you 5 baby melons, you. Appreciate the support of the channel, sir. Be sure and say thank you to Carolina Joe in the comments. Armando, what's going on? He says, do any banks back Affirm? What if Affirm goes under? Okay, so there are banks that back Affirm, but they have these flow-through agreements. One of the banks in particular, I've talked about these guys a lot. It's a bank called Cross River Bank from New Jersey. What happens is Affirm issues the loan. Cross River Bank immediately rubber stamps and approves that loan. But Affirm then immediately buys that loan from Cross River Bank. So the loan only resides on Cross River's books for like a couple of minutes, maybe a day. All right. Like the next day, Affirm buys that onto their books. Then Affirm takes those loans, packages it into an asset-backed security or a bond, and they sell it to investors, people's retirement funds. All right. A lot of like income ETFs own this stuff. So Affirm is kind of like a pipeline. The loans start at a bank that rubber stamps it using very rigorous credit control processes, I assure you. The loans start at the bank. Affirm immediately buys it, sits on Affirm's book for a couple of months probably while they package it up into bonds, and then they sell it off to investors. So the risk isn't really with the bank, because somehow what the bank is doing is legal. The risk is primarily with Affirm. If Affirm loses that outlet, if they're unable to sell those asset-backed securities into the market anymore, which, by the way, Carvana operates on a very similar business model, just with a lot more fraud involved. But if these companies are unable to tap the ABS market, they're going to dry up. Their liquidity goes away. They won't be able to keep buying these loans up, and the whole thing grinds to a halt. So a lot of these fintech startups, Affirm, Klarna, CarMax, Carvana, without the ABS market or any dysfunction in the asset-backed securities market, these companies are absolutely toast. And look at what CarMax and Carvana did in 2022, the last time things were not working so well in the ABS market. You'll see what their stocks did. You'll know what I'm talking about. Good question, Armando. Thank you, sir, for supporting the channel. Full of Hope 2222 says, why UK looking to move away from Visa, MasterCard? That is the first I've heard of that, Full of Hope. The only thing that comes to mind is sell America, right? You know, things are not, the US and Europe are not really playing so nice in the sandbox these days. And so there is a political drive to de-Americanize your business assets. Maybe that's why they're looking to move away from Visa and MasterCard. But this is the first I've heard of that. So honestly, I couldn't tell you why they're doing it because I haven't heard this story. Is there some European equivalent to Visa and MasterCard? If there is, I'm not really sure what it is. But yeah, my guess is it's just a side effect of the trade war and political differences. Thank you, Full of Hope, for supporting the channel. Travis is back again. He says, is this the year that we finally see a $200 bill? Those are rookie numbers. Trav, you got to bump those up. How about a K note? How about a $1,000 bill? All right. You know, let's swing for the fences here, brother. I see what you're saying there, though. We're no longer making pennies. We already took the silver out of the money. It's not backed by gold. So why not just mint the $1 trillion coin while we're at it? Yes. Thank you, Travis, for supporting the channel once again. You bonkers, buddy, you, sir. Armando's back again, says Full of Hope, because the U.S. weaponizes the dollar. We certainly did. We did absolutely weaponize the dollar. And even people who are our friends probably don't want to sit around and wait to wind up on the wrong end of that. That being said, there's no alternative still. You know, everybody talks a big game about de-dollarizing. I'll believe it when I see it. Because right now, for settlement of trade internationally, there is no alternative. Anybody who has tried to de-dollarize has run into problems with trade balance and accumulating vast piles of some other currency that they have no clue what to do with, and they're unable to unload it in the Forex market without crashing the value of it and sinking their own, lighting their own money on fire. Case in point was the trade between Russia and India in the oil market, and Russia sitting on a huge pile of increasingly worthless rupees after years of selling their oil to the Indians following the weaponization of the dollar. Again, it sounds like a great idea, but in practice, it's really freaking hard to do. Thank you, Armando, for supporting the channel. Carolina Joe says, Jack should stand up so we can prove he has pants. Oh, behave, Carolina. Oh, behave. No, sorry. We stay seated for the duration of the show. I guess you guys will just have to use your imagination there. And we got some pretty vivid imaginations in this chat. I'm not going to say. Keep it nice, guys. There might be some kids around. Hey, thanks again, Carolina Joe, for supporting the channel. Real Estate Mindset back again. Travis says, thank you, Jack. Great show. We're doing this, trying to get the last word in. It's like an argument with my daughters. You will never get the last word in as much as you may try. Thank you, Travis, for supporting the channel. And there is Armando says, oh, no, sir. I am the one who is last. Thank you, Armando. And Travis says, nope. Also, again, Armando last. All right, let's see how many of you guys could sneak those in during the outro music. Thank you guys for having your coffee with the Melon Heads this morning. Appreciate all the super chats and the support of the channel, as well as you, my magnanimous Melon Heads on YouTube, Patreon, and Buy Me a Coffee. Links down below, should you feel so inclined. Don't forget that like button and that subscribe button on the way out for the YouTube algorithm. I'll see you guys tomorrow. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. I love you guys. Armando says, you're welcome. Last words. Until next time, live small and dream big.